This is Eric Erickson, and I'm going to be talking today about Eric Erickson and his theory. I wanted you to see the twinkle in his eye and the smile that customarily played over his face. Hi, this is Larry. And I am not here today, as you may have noticed. But today's topic is, as I said, Eric Erickson, and he is one of my very favorite theorists. I find his theory very useful for understanding the process of development and the details of what people are doing throughout the entire lifespan, from birth to death. I encourage you to review the very brief introduction to Erickson's work that's given in chapter 2 in the text, and then ignore most of that since it really doesn't give you much of the flavor of what his theory is about. Erickson was born in 1902 in Frankfurt, Germany, and died in the United States in 1994. The text says that he was a German-born psychoanalyst, but it was very important to Erickson that he was Danish. He was born in Germany, but his parents were Danish. His father left the family when he was quite young, and he was raised by his mother and a German stepfather who was a pediatrician. His name was Homburger. Erickson had a typical German childhood growing up during the First World War, graduated from high school, having gone to the gymnasium, and did as many German youth did after the First World War. He set out to find himself, and to do that by being a traveling artist. He traveled through Europe and eventually ended up in Vienna, where, in his words, he found psychology. In the original edition of his first major book, Childhood and Society, he writes, "I came to psychology from art. At times the reader will find me painting contexts and backgrounds where he would rather have me point to facts and concepts." Erickson's is an artist's view of human development, a very informed artist's view, but clearly he was an artist both with paint, pastels, and with words, and his writing shows his artistic flair. And that makes it sometimes necessary to put on your artistic hat when you're reading him or when you're hearing about him, and think not about the experimental psychologists, but think about a person who was trying to describe the essence of human development in its context and across the entire lifespan. How did he discover psychology? In Vienna, and what brought him from art? He was doing as many German artists and other European artists did as they traveled around trying to find themselves. He was starving. He was trying to keep himself together. And he went to visit a friend of his, a man named Peter Bloss, with whom he had gone to high school. Peter Bloss was working in Vienna at an American school, and he suggested that Eric Erickson could be the gardener and perhaps do some art with the children in the American school. And that's where Erickson began. The school in Vienna was started by Dorothy Burlingham and Peter Bloss, under the tutelage of a psychoanalyst who was working in Vienna with her father. The father was Sigmund Freud. The daughter was Anna Freud. And Erikson became a student of Anna Freud while he was working in this school. Now, the school was very interesting because Anna Freud had set out to explore some of the dimensions of psychoanalytic theory that her father had pioneered, but she wanted to see how they applied to children and what lessons there were for teachers and for parents. So she and Dorothy Burlingham set up the school, taking advantage of the fact that there were Americans in Germany and she was fluent in English. Burlingham was English. And they set out to create a school that would be run according to psychoanalytic principles, where the lessons that her father had passed on to her, and this was a time when he was still active, the lessons that he had passed on could be applied to children's education to see if children could be raised so that they developed more fully and with fewer of the neurotic hang-ups that Victorian children were suffering from their parents. As a result of the work in this school, Anna Freud wrote probably the best introduction to psychoanalytic theory and particularly its view of development that you will find. So if you're interested in exploring psychoanalytic theory, particularly as it applies to children, one of the easiest access points is her book called Psychoanalysis for Parents and Teachers. And I recommend that as a wonderful starting place. And it grew out of this work with children in the school. So Erikson did a combination of trimming the hedges and art with children. And along the way, Dorothy and Peter and Anna discovered that Eric had very good rapport with children, was a fine artist, and the children really enjoyed being with him. And he started exploring the use of art as a way of exploring children's feelings and helping them become articulate about how they were feeling. He became interested in child development and decided he wanted to get more training. And so he and Anna Freud began a training analysis for him. These were in the days when you didn't have to go to college, you didn't have to go to medical school, you didn't have to spend 5 years in a psychoanalytic institute to become a psychoanalyst. So all you had to do was be smart and undergo a training analysis and hang out with other psychoanalysts. So Erikson set out to do that. And he was eventually analyzed by August Eichhorn, who was part of the Freud circle in Vienna at that time. And as a result of that training analysis, he was able then to become an analyst. Again, in his words, "I first came face to face with children in a small American school in Vienna, which was conducted by Dorothy Burlingham and Peter Bloss. I began my clinical career as what is commonly called a child analyst, which does not mean that I psychoanalyzed while still a child, but that I first psychoanalyzed children. In this, I was guided by Anna Freud and the late August Eichhorn. I graduated from the Vienna Psychoanalytic Institute." Okay, so he has training as an artist at the secondary school level, and he has the beginning of psychoanalysis and some work with children. Then came his primary training in human development. Psychoanalysis taught him about conversations and interpretation and feelings. But Anna Freud was particularly interested in the work of other people, teachers, who were working with young children. And she knew of the work of an Italian doctor who had developed some rather revolutionary ideas about young children's development and education. And this pediatrician in Rome, a woman, was running a training program that lasted close to a year. And people were invited to come and study with her. So Anna Freud and Dorothy Berlingham decided that Eric should go to Rome and study with Maria Montessori. And it was there that he developed one of the fundamental principles of his understanding of how development happens. Maria Montessori, as you probably know, was the first woman to graduate from the medical school at the University of Rome. She was the first woman to attend medical school there in the late 1800s. They wouldn't admit women because women weren't supposed to know about the body, and they particularly weren't supposed to study it by dissecting it or examining people. That was something that men could do. But she persisted, and she was from a wealthy family in Rome, and her parents were quite prominent. So the medical school faculty decided that they would let Maria study medicine if her father came to classes with her. So Maria Montessori graduated from the University of Rome as a physician because her father went to all of her classes with her. She had to have the chaperone and his permission. What did Erik Erikson learn from Maria Montessori? Let's look at Montessori's work. Maria Montessori contributed a great deal to education and to our understanding of children. One of her fundamental threads is that children are innately active in the world, and they strive to organize the things they encounter. If this sounds a little bit like Piaget, Piaget studied Montessori. He knew her work. In so doing, children create the patterns of thinking around which their minds will be organized, from orderly materials and surroundings, an orderly mind will emerge. From chaotic disorganization will emerge a disorganized, ineffective mind. Now, Maria Montessori got to that position by looking at children who were being raised in the slums of Rome. Her first job was as the pediatrician in an institution for children who weren't very bright. They were called feeble-minded, and they were not developing adequately. When Maria arrived at this institution, she discovered that they had very little in the way of materials, they were lacking stimulation, they came from poor families, there was nothing in their world that was orderly. So she began to explore how they had gotten that way and whether or not they could be educated by providing appropriate materials. Over many years, she discovered the connection between the organization or orderliness of the home that children are raised in and the orderliness of their minds. What she concluded about the children who were growing up in the slums of Rome was that they were not becoming intelligent and they were not ready for school. They wouldn't do well in school because they had never learned the basic principles of organization. Remember, Piaget said that organization is a fundamental principle of intellectual development. Organization and adaptation to the world and the experience that you're having. What Montessori was doing was looking at the organization and the disorganization of that world that children were exploring in their homes and saying, if that world is disorganized, the children can't organize it themselves. So she was describing a transaction between the materials, the schedule, the order, the routines in the home, and the development of logical thinking. Now, her approach to child development is much more complex than that, But that was the essence that Erickson took away. By the way, he completed her training program and was certified as a Montessori teacher. So now we have a guy who graduated from the gymnasium, the high school, has a credential as a psychoanalyst and a Montessori certificate. Keep that in mind when you look at the rest of his career. He didn't go to college, he didn't go to medical school. Erickson left Germany in 1932. The Nazis were coming to power. He was Jewish. He didn't like Germany. He didn't like his stepfather. That had been an unpleasant relationship. And so he decided to strike out for the New World, come to the United States, and landed here looking for work as a child analyst. His English was pretty good, and psychoanalysis was beginning to be quite popular in the United States, and there were very few child analysts. So he arrived here. He eventually got a job at Berkeley in California, working on the Berkeley Growth Study, which was a longitudinal project that was looking at children's development from birth up through adolescence and looking at the parenting they were receiving. And he began to do research on how the children organized their world. He would do block structures. He would bring them into a room and give them a standard set of blocks and see what they produced. These were 3 and 4 and 5 year old children. That research is still quite interesting, and people replicate it occasionally. And then he ran into difficulty there during the McCarthy years in the United States, because McCarthy, and if you don't know that history, go look it up. Joseph McCarthy, who is the protagonist in the new movie about Edward R. Murrow, who fought with him. McCarthy was encouraging people to root out all the communists, and he was particularly interested in foreign intellectuals, which Erickson qualified for. And the regents of the California system insisted that faculty sign a loyalty oath. And Erickson and many other people refused to do that. And Erickson was fired by the University of California. And it wasn't just California that was doing that. In Vermont, one of our faculty also was fired by our board of trustees because he refused to sign that oath and, as part of the oath, to state whether or not he had ever been a member of the Communist Party. It took the university about 30 years to apologize and grant that particular professor an honorary doctorate. He went on to become quite famous as a biologist researcher. So here's Erickson without a job. He ends up in Massachusetts as a child analyst at the Austin Riggs Center and writing books. I mentioned the first one, major one, Childhood and Society. He eventually became a faculty member at Harvard, was a lecturer in the medical school, lecturer in human development, and spent the rest of his career affiliated with Harvard until he retired. A faculty member at Harvard in the medical school without a medical degree, without a doctorate, without a college degree. And Erickson found that quite amusing, and he used to say that Harvard was a very liberal institution because it would look at what you could do and what you did, what you could teach, rather than what your credentials were. Along the way, Erickson acquired one of the best written at the time, published in the 1960s. She later was very highly regarded as a weaver. And if you would like to know what it was like to live with Erickson, and to be his wife, and to admire her, because she was quite a woman herself. The UVM Library has two videos one on Joan Erickson at 90, and the other Joan Erickson at 92. And there are interviews with her where she talks about her own work and her husband. Erickson was suffering from senile dementia in his last years. When the video of Joan Erickson at 90 was made, he was suffering, and she had finally had to place him in a nursing home. She talks about that process in the video. In the second video, Joan Erickson at 92, she's describing his death and her own adaptation to widowhood at that point. I recommend looking at those as a way of both understanding Erickson in his later years and a wonderful portrait of a very admirable woman. In his later years, Erickson acknowledged that Joan Erickson was the co-author of nearly all of his work. He had thanked her in his early work and his publications, but later in life he recognized that she not only edited every word he wrote, but she contributed regularly to his thinking and to the ideas for which he became famous. So it took him a while, but he got there. She didn't need it because she was highly regarded in her own right, but I was pleased that he finally gave her due in regard to his own work. Okay, let's look at Erickson's theory. What did he do with Maria Montessori's notion? And how does it fit with his training as a psychoanalyst? Erickson, like most psychoanalysts, also studied biology. Sigmund Freud was interested in the nature of the human being. His degree was in physiology. He had done his doctoral research in medical school on the development of the gonads in eels, and dissected eels and studied their gonads. So he was interested in sex from the beginning. And I guess eels are very, very sexy creatures. But Erickson picked up on Freud's notion that we don't give enough credit to our biological nature. And Freud had tried to bring in the notion of our biology and our sexual drives into his understanding of behavior and of development. Erickson picked up on that and articulated a basic principle from biology, which should sound familiar to you since it's one of the tenets of embryology, everybody's embryology, including our own prenatal development. Anything that grows has a ground plan, a blueprint. And out of this blueprint, the parts arise, the ground plan, the genetic structure. Each part has its time of special ascendancy until all parts have arisen to form a functioning whole. Each part has its time of special ascendancy should echo in your brains as differentiation. Each part emerges different from what has gone before and then gets integrated with the rest, all the other parts, to form a functioning whole, a system that combines all of the parts that arose separately and differentially. What he's describing is fundamental to all of biological development, and he is saying that that also characterizes our psychological development. That as we develop, there are different parts, different aspects of our personalities that emerge and get integrated with what has come before until they become a functioning whole, and that process continues through 8 stages. that he defined. So, if we think about where Montessori is, she is saying that the mind, I'm going to use the word psyche here from the Greek, the mind reflects the orderliness of the context. Children are experiencing a context, and their minds will reflect the degree of organization of that context. Erickson is adding to that, and this is consistent with Montessori as well, that there is a sequence, there is a plan, a sequence of steps that are going to take place as we develop. Now, let's go back to his psychoanalytic training. Freud, Sigmund Freud, was looking at this biology, and he was arguing that the biological drives, particularly the sexual or libido, which he also many times called the life force, just the force of being alive, just that force of being alive, motivates us and shapes the way the mind develops. His developmental theory suggested that the biological changes in the body, channeling this libidinal energy, shape the urges, the desires, the way we think, how we respond to the world that we live in. The social context responds to us, to the way we express those drives, and makes us neurotic. Freud described his theory as a psychosexual theory, because his emphasis was on the relationship between the body and the life force urges and the mind or psyche. So he was putting those two together, and he called it a psychosexual theory of development. How does the mind reflect the biology and the changes in the body as the child becomes able to gain control, or is urged by the context to gain control of each of the parts of the body? And how do you figure out how to stop wetting? How do you figure out how to eat? How do you figure out how to crap where you're supposed to crap? Freud had focused on the psychosexual. He acknowledged the role of parents and society. He wrote a great deal about the role of parents and society in dealing with children's sexual drives. But his focus developmentally was on the stages that children go through. Anna Freud, with whom Erickson is working now, has expanded the notion of context to talk about the transactions that parents and teachers particularly have with children as they're trying to develop children's psyches. And she was acknowledging her father's theory that was, in her view, correct. She went on to elaborate it greatly, provide a great deal more detail, look at far more aspects of children's development than just their libidinal urges. She actually looked at their social relationships, their peer relationships, conscience, more than her father did. And she was interested in those transactions, particularly the important adults in a child's family, as they were affecting the developing personality and mind. She describes her approach as developmental psychoanalysis. Erickson expanded both views. He elaborated on both. He accepted the notion that we are biological organisms, that's in his epigenetic principle, and that there are probably stages, or there's a sequence of changes, physically, biologically, and along with that, potentially, a sequence of changes in the mind, changes in the personality, that go along with the changes in the body. He took Anna Freud's work on parents and teachers and peers and some other work that was being done at that time of people who were taking Freud's theory and applying it to anthropology. Anthropologists had a great influence on making Freud popular because they went out to other cultures, the Trobriand Islanders, Samoa, Margaret Mead. All those folks took their psychoanalytic background out to primitive cultures to see if psychoanalytic theory would describe them, if it applied to them, and if other cultures were perhaps raising their children freely so that they were developing fully without becoming neurotic. The Victorians in Germany and England and Europe generally were teaching kids that sex was bad, any kind of urge should be stomped on, and that was creating neuroses, Freud said. The anthropologists were going out to see if they could find people who weren't nearly as neurotic as the Americans and the Europeans. Erickson knew about that work, and after he came to the United States, he did anthropological field work with American Indians in the Southwest and in the Northwest. And later he went to rural villages in India and spent time there studying families and the culture and children's development to see what kinds of effects different cultures and different kinds of parenting had on kids. That was a major influence for him. He was looking at the context particularly of the family and the society as it directed the transactions of teachers and parents, as it defined the expectations for transactions that the developing individual was going to be engaged in. To distinguish his work from Sigmund Freud and his psychosexual theory of development, Erickson defined his as a psychosocial theory of development. And that seems to have stuck, since every other chapter in your textbook is called psychosocial development. It works. He was interested in how the social context shapes the mind and the psyche, starting with the foundation of the biology. He's describing what we all, in his view, try to do. We try to create a self, an ego, that is healthy and sound, that responds to the biological changes that take place as we grow through life, and that responds to and tries to deal with healthy transactions with the society that we're growing up in, our family, our particular partners, our social relationships. So Erickson's theory is a transactional theory and a constructivist theory. He is arguing that the person from birth on is making sense out of the demands and the urges that we experience just because we're biological organisms, and the demands and expectations and transactions that we have with the significant people in our relationships, in our society, in our context. How do you make sense out of all of that? Oh, he added another piece too, which is that as he began to look at this process, he said, yes, it characterizes children. Yes, it characterizes adolescents. We never stop. So for Erikson, it made sense that the theory would be a lifespan theory, from birth to death. From one end of the epigenesis, the beginning of life, to the end of life. We're all engaged in the same process of trying to make sense, bring together, to adapt to our bodies and their demand, our body. How do we say that? We're each trying to adapt to our body and its demands and challenges, and the social context. And the social context is similar for us, but unique. We each have our own unique one. This is the process. If I were there, I would stop now and ask for any questions, but since I'm not there, you're just gonna have to write them down. I'll give you about 30 seconds to write down your question, and I'll deal with them when I get back. Okay, you're back, I'm back. What did he come up with? Eight stages. Now this is the artist at work. His stages map on biological changes in the body, but they're not specifically defined biologically. What he did over the many years that he worked on his stage theory was to try to define what are the psychosocial issues for us as we develop. What are we responding to? What are the expectations? What are the challenges for the psyche? This work was primarily informed by his clinical work. Remember, he's a psychoanalyst. He has children and adolescents coming to him, brought by their parents because they have problems. Problems in adaptation, problems in life, problems doing what they're supposed to do. So his goal is to figure out how to describe those problems. And these eight are listed in the text and many other places. Starting at birth, during infancy, the psychosocial issues he finally landed on were trust and mistrust, autonomy, shame and doubt, initiative and guilt, industry and inferiority for the elementary school years, adolescence, the famous sense of identity and role confusion, intimacy and isolation, generativity, passing something on to the future, or stagnating. And in later life, keeping it together and making sense out of what has gone before in the face of not having much time left. And if you can't make sense out of that, if you can't feel good about it, have a sense of integrity, then despair comes because you can't do anything about it now, although you might make apologies. There are a couple of problems with this list. I lifted this from another text. First problem is that the opposite of identity is not role confusion. Your text uses identity confusion. Erikson used identity diffusion. And that's a very important distinction. We'll talk about it. The word is diffusion. as in diffused light, scattered, scattered. A scattered identity instead of a sense of true identity. We'll talk about that probably Monday. The second problem with this description, with this list, is that it's upside down. It's upside down. This is the way Erickson came to understand it. What he wanted to portray was that we start at the beginning of development. You all know that development for me goes from left to right. For Erickson, it goes left to right and bottom to top. So he wanted to reverse his earlier drawings and his list and say that we start in infancy and then we move up through the various stages. What he eventually drew was a chart that looked like this. Okay. So in this chart, on the diagonal, he puts trust, autonomy, initiative, and guilt, indicating that we're moving up and along developmentally, simultaneously. So he's putting it on the diagonal axis. And then he set himself the task that he never finished of looking at each stage as having hints of what was going to come after, and as you got to it, picking up those hints, the precursors of the major issue at each stage. That got a little too complicated for him to deal with, but what he eventually wanted to do was to indicate that in the issue of trust in infancy, you have elements of trust that eventually will be part of autonomy. It's hard, for example, to become autonomous if you don't trust yourself. It's hard to take initiative if you have too much self-doubt. I'm not going to go into that, but just think about the possibilities as he came to see it, that he had identified 8 major psychosocial issues that we experience as they ascend. Each comes to its ascendancy. Each is the most important of the psychosocial issues during its particular stage, but we're always wrestling with the other issues as well. So theoretically, he thought he could fill in all 64 of those rectangles. How do the stages work? The stages are defined by the challenges inherent in individual development. That's this, individual development. The body and the mind are developing, the mind based on the brain. So as we saw in our biological unit, the body is developing and there are challenges in that. Becoming toilet trained, learning to walk, learning to run, being able to play sports or games, going through puberty, dealing with sex, having babies, going through menopause, falling apart, facing death. Those are challenges that are inherent in individual development. And there is a corresponding set of expectations, demands, risks, and opportunities. What do I mean by a corresponding set? Here is one of Erickson's most important contributions. Erickson deals with nature and nurture in a very sophisticated way. Nature, we recognize as part of the inherent challenges of biological development. Nurture, in Erickson's view, represented by teachers, child-rearing practices, families, society, culture, evolved with human beings. Our social systems, our social institutions, our social expectations are coordinated with the changes in our bodies. They have co-evolved, he said. Human beings have evolved a lifespan with a changing body and a changing mind that goes along with that. Our cultures know that because they've evolved with it. And what he drew from anthropology is that every society recognizes the epigenetic principle. Every society recognizes that the body changes and it provides challenges to the individual and to the society as it evolves, as it develops. So every society has a way of dealing with death. Every society has a way of dealing with birth. Every society has expectations around toilet training, around feeding yourself, around walking, around physical activity and games. Every society deals with puberty in some way, with mating, with childbirth, with raising children, with menopause, with sickness, with illness, with death. Societies coordinate their expectations so that the expectations are, in fact, based on the individual development that we all go through, which is universal to human beings. For Erickson, that creates the structure of the stages. The structure of the stages is the structure of the transaction of individual development and the social context. So in his view, all societies are dealing with the same issues, and therefore the eight psychosocial stages, as he's defined them, apply in all cultures. How they're dealt with will be different in each culture, and that's where his theory becomes useful. Because different people in different cultures face different social expectations as they're going through the lifespan. Within each stage, there's a continuum of possibilities defined by the opposing tendencies or poles, trust and mistrust, autonomy and shame, the definitions that he gives for each of the eight stages. Each is defined by some issue that defines a continuum with opposite poles, trust, mistrust, identity, and identity diffusion or singleness, and diffusion, intimacy, or isolation. During the particular stage, the person will explore the range of resolutions of that issue. Trust will be an issue for the infant. Mistrust will be explored because your parents will not always show up when you need them. They won't recognize your needs when you need them. They won't be reliable always. So you're going to have to figure out as an infant how you deal with figuring out whether this is a trustable environment that you're in or not. As you explore the range of possibilities along that continuum from deep trust, basic trust, to very deep mistrust, you will gradually resolve that issue and develop or adopt a particular attitude, which he calls a sense of trust or a sense of mistrust. Where you settle on that continuum depends on individual developmental factors, how quickly you go through the stages, on your gender, on temperament, personality, So what your body is doing, what your mind is dealing with as you go through changes, and simultaneously the transactions that you're having. But the expectations, the demands, the possibilities that are provided by your particular context. As an example, in our culture, we generally think that parents should be trustworthy and treat children nicely, particularly in infancy. We don't systematically annoy babies. We don't take candy and food away from them. We don't pinch them. You would probably think that a society that did that was really weird. There are societies in which that happens. There are societies in which there are many evil spirits, and if you're going to survive infancy and childhood, you need to learn to watch out for the evil spirits. You need to be able to detect them, you need to be able to avoid them. In other words, you need to become a little bit paranoid because the world really is an evil place that's out to get you. And in cultures that have that kind of belief, that they've evolved as a society, it may be very important to treat an infant in ways that will make it suspicious. So adults have, in those societies, an obligation to make babies mistrustful. And you do that by randomly annoying them, by pinching them, by waking them up, by taking food away from them, by teasing them. Literally taking the candy away from the baby. That context has an attitude toward its environment. They've interpreted the environment that says you need to be suspicious. They deal with basic trust and mistrust by pushing kids toward the mistrustful side, and they see that as healthy. They see that as desirable. Once you've developed your particular sense, your stance on the continuum, then you approach the future stages from that stance. So if you're a kid who's learned in infancy that the world is a very trustable place, it's very trustworthy, people don't annoy you, people take care of your needs, you're raised the way all of us wish we were raised, not having to deal with lots of stress, then we go into the next stage with that basic sense of trust. And we're going to carry that sense of trust with us into the next stage, and that's going to shape the transactions that we have with our context in the next stage. If we're the child who's been taught to be paranoid, we're going to take that sense of mistrust into the next stage, and that's going to shape the way we deal with autonomy. We're going to perhaps want to be more autonomous because we're mistrustful. So in Erickson's view, these stages are cumulative. The sense that you resolve any particular stage with carries on and shapes your transactions with your context in the next stage, and the next, and the next. You're accumulating these to make a functioning whole personality as you develop. As I said, it's essentially a constructivist theory. It's a cumulative theory. It relies on transactional views of experience. Normal and healthy are defined from multiple perspectives. The text and many books about Erickson tend to suggest that you have to successfully resolve a stage. There's going to be something wrong with you if you don't have a good, healthy sense of trust. That wasn't Erickson's view. Erickson's view was that normal and healthy is defined in part by the context that you're in, because it's a process of adaptation to those transactions. If you are in a world that can't be trusted, it's abnormal it's maladaptive, it's unhealthy to be a very trusting person. So what makes a person healthy is finding a good and stable resolution that allows them to have a sense of understanding their environment. If I understand my environment, if I can deal with my environment competently, then I'm healthy. And if a lot of mistrust helps me do that in my particular context, then mistrust is healthy. Understanding your environment, being adapted to it, keeps your anxiety level low. Remember disequilibrium in Piaget's theory? If you don't understand something, you get anxious, you get upset, you try to figure it out. Erickson's in the same ballpark. If you don't understand your context, if you can't deal with it competently, then you're subject to anxiety. And then you try to make better sense out of the environment that you're in. If you're really anxious and can't make sense out of your environment and or yourself, then you go to therapy. That's what his theory is good for. If you're not able to deal with your environment, if you can't hack it in college, if you can't deal with your roommates, if you think you're a total jerk, if you think you're a failure, if you think everybody hates you, then you go to therapy. And the therapist helps you sort out why you understand yourself and the world and how you understand it, so that you can come to understand yourself and the world in a more helpful way. Okay, I'm going to stop there for now, and on Monday we'll start with some of the misunderstandings of Piaget's stages, and then we'll look particularly at adolescence and young adulthood. I assume those are the stages you're most interested in understanding. Have a great weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.